This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In her 20s, Jody Williams bounced from job to grad school to job, never quite finding the right fit. She was interested in international affairs. She dabbled in teaching. But it wasn't until someone shoved a flyer into her hand on a rainy day in Washington, D.C., that she found her calling, activism. In 1997, that activism led Jody Williams to the Nobel Peace Prize. She and the organization she led, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, won the Peace Prize for their work pushing governments around the world to end the production and use of these indiscriminate weapons of war. Williams has just published a memoir detailing her unlikely rise to the world stage. It's called My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. The Putney native joins us today to talk about her life and work. Jody Williams, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. I'm glad to be here. And by the way, when you say the title of my book, it sounds really good. When I say it, it sounds kind of creepy.
You never quite know when you're reading somebody else's title what inflection they want. So I appreciate
that. The inflection
was
perfect.
Let's just jump right into the middle of the story here, and then we can pull apart the themes and the threads. 1996, about 5 years into your work, a group of countries meet to discuss this idea of banning landmines. Can you take us to that conference, to that time, and what you were hoping to get out of that conference?
Sure. We had been pressing governments for about 2.5 years prior to that conference. There is an existing treaty called the Convention on Conventional Weapons, and it has a section that deals with landmines. And we had been hoping that we could put enough pressure on them that during a review conference of that treaty, they would ban the weapon. That did not happen after 2.5 years of work. But what did happen was we were able to bring together a core of governments who had the same goal as we did, wanted to see a complete ban on the weapon. And as the Convention on Conventional Weapons Conference came to a horrific end, horrific in the sense it was made weaker instead of stronger.
You didn't think that was a very good good piece of legislation to begin with. It had no teeth.
It was terrible. It had no teeth at all. But it ended on May 3rd of 1996. But out of that process, Canada, which is what really surprised us, changed from holding the exact position as the U.S. to saying they wanted to host a new conference that would bring together countries that really wanted to ban the weapon. And that was in October of that same year, 1996. And that conference changed the landmine ban world.
And in fact, yeah, the Canadians said, look, we don't want to just say we're going to ban landmines. We're going to do this in a year. Coming together in 1 year in 1997, as you mentioned, and we're going to do this. And it sounds like most of the people at this 1996 convention were flabbergasted.
The diplomats were angry, to be honest. They had no expectation that Lloyd Axworthy, who was the foreign minister at that time, was going to make that challenge as he closed the conference. We knew my husband and I, actually Steve Goose, who's the director of the Arms Division, which is weapons of Human Rights Watch, and I were told by Canadian colleagues in the government, so we'd be ready to be, you know, cheering and happy, which we really were. And the International Committee of the Red Cross had been told as well. But the diplomats themselves had no idea that after 2.5 days of working supposedly to make a roadmap that would eventually lead us to a ban, that Axworthy would congratulate them for that work and then say, but that's not enough. Canada challenges you now, because you keep saying you're pro-ban, to negotiate a treaty within 1 year, and we will sign it back here in Ottawa with even one or two other countries, if that's all that are willing to sign. And the diplomats really were steaming. They were caught between their rhetoric and, a public challenge. It was fabulous.
I'm talking today with Nobel Peace Laureate Jody Williams. She grew up in southern Vermont and went on, as she just mentioned, to challenge world governments in a campaign to ban landmines. Listeners, if you have a question for Jody Williams or want to talk about the state of peace activism today, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So here's this challenge. Lloyd Axworthy has said, we've got a year. We're going to come together in a year, and we're going to make a treaty to ban landmines. Canada's going to sign it. If one other country comes with us, we're doing this. And a year later, December of 1997, convention is held. How many countries signed that treaty?
122. It was incredible because after the challenge, their negotiating process was set up. There were meetings in Bonn, Germany. There were meetings in Brussels, Belgium. The final negotiating was in Oslo, Norway, in September of 1997. And when we got to Oslo, I think there were 89 countries who were there for the negotiations. And yet, you know, from the end of September until December 3rd and 4th, when the treaty was signed, the number jumped from 89 to 122. And we believe that the Peace Prize had a lot to do with that.
Not the U.S., though. The U.S. did not sign it and, in fact, tried to derail the treaty convention in December.
This is true. We were thrilled that the world, you know, hung together, recognizing that this was an indiscriminate weapon that had to be banned because it stayed in the ground long, long, long after ends of wars. And then everybody it killed or maimed was a civilian because the wars were long over. And the U.S. was very stubborn on trying to derail it, but it had nothing to do about whether or not our military needed anti-personnel landmines, which is, of course, ludicrous if you look at the way this country conducts war today. It was about the military not wanting to give in to civil society, ordinary people like you and me. You know, how dare we come together and try to pressure them to give up weapons? You know, that's their area, and we have nothing to say about it. Clearly, we disagreed.
Well, we got a note from Peggy, who posted on our online discussion and asks, what do you think it would take to get the U.S. to sign on to the ban? She says, my brother runs an NGO in Vietnam and sees uncountable numbers of legs blown off, people killed, etc., from landmines that are still everywhere over there, and this country has done nothing to clean them up.
Well, let me explain a little bit, because that's not quite the case. Mm-hmm. The U.S., yes, hasn't signed. Currently, Mr. Obama has a couple of options on his desk about the treaty after months and months and months and months and months of review, which, you know, Bush had done the similar review, so I'm not quite clear how many times they have to review the same thing. But he has a couple of options. He has said nothing so far. But the U.S. is actually obeying the treaty. We haven't used anti-personnel landmines since 1991. We haven't exported since Senator Leahy passed legislation to stop the export in 92. We haven't produced landmines since the mid-90s. And we have destroyed millions in our stockpiles, all of which are obligations under that treaty. Additionally, the U.S. is the biggest funder for mine action, which is, you know, landmine clearance and survivor assistance. And they do give money to Vietnam now. They didn't before. This is true. So, you know, when you think about it that way, why would they not sign the treaty and look like, at least on this one little issue, they actually believed in multilateralism in the world together? But they still are holding out.
Do you have a theory on that?
I think it has to do with the military more than anything else. They were very angry when Clinton came very, very close to banning landmines. And there was a meeting of the regional commanders in the military. And a couple of them kind of went ballistic and pushed back very hard against the ban. And he backed down. in my view, he abdicated his power as the commander-in-chief of the military, as well as the president who should be setting foreign policy. He let the military tell him what to do about landmines. I thought that was pretty horrific.
And do you think that set a precedent for his successors?
Well, certainly W didn't want to sign anything. In fact, he unsigned a treaty. I think it's the only time in history that a U.S. president has actually unsigned. I think if, you know, when I think about politics and how you have to weigh this against that when you're deciding which policies to take forward if you're the president, you know, he came striding in with the health insurance issue. He talked big about doing something with nuclear weapons. So if he had decided to sign this treaty and put it before the Senate, you know, for ratification, he kind of would have used up all of his chits on arms control on that treaty, in a way, if you know, if you think about how politics works. And I think he thought he had bigger fish to fry, so to speak, and he's still waiting.
Jody, you mentioned that there were some provisions of this treaty, and they were things that you and your organization, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, had pushed for. So it included banning the use of landmines, mm-hmm. banning the production of landmines, and mm-hmm. working to remove landmines, which mm-hmm. includes paying for that removal.
Correct.
What else is in the treaty that people should be aware of?
Well, it's a complete ban, meaning use, production, trade, stockpiling. So if you were a landmine producer, you had to dismantle your production facilities. If you were a trader, you had to stop trading. You had to destroy all your stockpiles, which meant, you know, that it was kind of like preventative mine clearance. If they never went in the ground, there wouldn't be victims caused by these weapons. And the one thing that was kind of revolutionary in that treaty was the inclusion of language about survivors. And it wasn't language that was obligatory like reparation, but it called upon governments to, you know, to the best of their ability to contribute to mine clearance and to survivor assistance. And that was a very huge breakthrough. And at last count that I know of, the amount over the years that has been donated for that is somewhere between $3 and $5 billion, which is a huge amount of money. And that also is the result of the work of the campaign, you know, keeping the pressure on governments to obey the treaty, to do what they said they were going to do, and to keep, you know, putting money into it until the job is done and the world really is free of landmines.
Well, who's responsible for putting that pressure on? I mean, you mentioned the CCW, the convention to ban certain conventional weapons.
Yeah, that
and,
was irrelevant.
And how you didn't think it had any teeth. So how has this treaty been effective?
Well, the landmine campaign grew from two non-governmental organizations, one in the U.S., of course, the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, and a humanitarian relief organization in Germany, Medico International, and a staff of one, me. But because it was U.S. and Germany, I could call it the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, and I made it sound very formidable. But we grew to 1,300 non-governmental organizations in between 80 and 90 countries around the world. And I think that when the gavel came down successfully on the negotiations on, I think it was the 17th of September, 97, in Oslo, I really believe the government's expected/hoped that we would declare victory, disband the campaign, and go do something else. Instead, we had been holding like a week-long meeting during the negotiations in a different place, but planning our strategy for what we would be doing immediately after the signing in December in Canada to make sure the treaty became binding law and to keep putting pressure on governments to obey it. And the landmine campaign is vibrant, still there, pressing governments, working with governments to make sure the job is done. And I believe that that is why it is so successful.
This work that we're talking about here in pushing for this treaty to end the use and production of landmines led directly to your organization, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, mm-hmm. and to you individually mm-hmm. being named co-winners of the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize. I know you say in the book that people always want to ask, what did that mean? What did it feel like? But, mm-hmm. you know, it is something that so few people get to experience. Mm-hmm. What did it mean to you to win that prize?
Well, it meant several things. You know, as a campaigner, you know, as one of the, you know, thousands and in some ways millions of people around the world who had worked in one way or another for this ban, I was totally thrilled. I truly believe that the work of the campaign merited that prize. I think it is a very clear example of the kind of thing that Nobel had in mind in his will. That I got it personally made Mom and Dad happy. They got off my back about doing something they could explain, like be a lawyer.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. But I am by nature an introvert, which does not mean that you can't have a public persona. It doesn't mean that you can't be articulate. But it's very draining for me to be in public all the time. And I'm in public pretty much all the time. So that was a huge stressor for me, learning over the years, and it took quite a while, how to manage my public being and my at-home person. I cried a lot in the first few years after I'd go to a convention or something and people wanted to hear all of my pearls of wisdom about everything, which is ridiculous. I could talk about landmines, but I didn't know everything related to peace. And there's some weird expectation that suddenly you know everything, right? That was very, very difficult for me. And I think when I came together with other women who received the Peace Prize, six of us, and we created the Nobel Women's Initiative, which was launched in January of 2006, where we tried to use the influence and access that we women have by virtue of the Peace Prize to support women working around the world for sustainable peace with justice and equality. That's when the Peace Prize for me personally really came to mean a lot, because now I feel like through that work, I'm able to share the prize with grassroots activists, which I still consider myself to be a grassroots activist. And I can share it through the Nobel Women's Initiative with amazing women working in unbelievable circumstances to try to bring peace. And so that was, now it's pretty awesome. But at first it was rough.
Well, we have a question for you about the women's initiative that you're talking about, mm-hmm. and more questions for you about this trajectory of your life, which seemed so unexpected, in mm-hmm. at least when you were in your 20s. Uh-huh. More with Jody Williams just ahead. We're talking about her life and her new book. My name is Jody Williams. And listeners, if you have questions for her, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today I'm talking with Jody Williams. The Putney native made a name for herself in the late 90s, urging an international treaty to ban the production and use of landmines as a weapon of war. Her work led to a Nobel Peace Prize. We're talking about Williams' activism and life, which she details in her new memoir, My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. And listeners, if you have a question or if you want to talk to Jody Williams, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So I want to talk more about the Nobel Women's Initiative. But Jody, I mentioned before at the break that this was sort of a winding path for you. And, mm-hmm. and you detail this in the book. You had a couple of jobs and a couple of relationships in your 20s that really made you miserable and made you try to think about, what the heck am I doing with my life? Mm-hmm. And then some guy hands you a pamphlet on a rainy evening. You're getting on the subway in D.C. after a long day of work. You're kind of cranky. And he hands you this pamphlet and it changes your life.
Mm-hmm. How?
Yeah.
Well, my first protest was in May of 1970 against the war in Vietnam when I was at the University of Vermont. And with that war, for many of us of my age, you know, I graduated from university in 72, it just changed, you know, our beliefs about all the wonders of American mythology about itself. You know, the U.S., I think, is an amazing and wonderful country in so many ways. I believe Americans are warm and welcoming and all that. Our foreign policy, however, is awful, in my view. And I was first awakened to that in the Vietnam period. And then, as you point out, you know, I drifted and, you know, a variety of jobs, school again because I didn't know what to do with myself. And every time I shifted into another confusingly boring job, my parents would say, "They say you're so smart. Why don't you go be a lawyer?" But then in D.C., I was handed a pamphlet, and it said on the cover, "El Salvador, another Vietnam," with a question mark. And by that time, I'd lived in Mexico for a couple of years, so I was, you know, familiar with the region. And if that pamphlet had not said Vietnam, I would have thrown it away. But I couldn't imagine the connection. So, of course, I wanted to read it. And when I read it, it talked about U.S. intervention in El Salvador, not by directly sending troops, but by sending millions and millions of dollars to support the dictatorship that was crushing attempts at democracy. And it also said, you know, if you want to know what's being done in your name with your tax dollars, you know, there will be a meeting a week away in the basement of a church. Please come. The thing that amazes me most when I think about all of my history is that I actually went a week later. Because you know how you can get, you know, excited and inspired. And if the event is going to be like in an hour, you'll probably go. But when it's a week later, you know, your passion kind of dies down. Other things seem so much more important, like reading a book or washing your hair, and you don't go. I'll never quite understand why I went, but I went. And at the end of that meeting, when they handed around a sheet for volunteers, I signed up. And that changed my life.
That really led you on a path to activism. You worked on Central American issues and issues with U.S. intervention for several years and then moved into landmines. Mm-hmm. When you started, did you think that this particular issue would be landmines, that is, would be a passion for you? Or was it just another job that worked on activism that seemed like a good cause?
I didn't feel passionate about it initially. I felt passionately thrilled that I was not going to have to talk about El Salvador and death squads and all that stuff that I had been talking about for almost 11 years, that I was going to learn new things. I didn't know that much about landmines and the laws of war, that, you know, there were landmines in 80 countries or so around the world. So I would have a global stage to learn things in. And it was exciting to me. And then as I started, you know, pushing to bring NGOs together in the campaign, that became totally, engrossing and filled me with passion to see if we could actually bring enough non-governmental organizations together and strategize toward a common goal of banning landmines and make something happen. That would be marvelous. At the time, I really didn't think there would be a treaty banning landmines anytime soon, but I thought if we could do anything that would make the situation on the ground better for the survivors or people living in minefields, I thought that would be pretty awesome.
We've got some listeners who want to chime in and ask you a few questions and talk mm-hmm. with you. Let's go to Douglas calling in from Berlin. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
My question is, if the U.S. is following the rules of the treaty but just not signing, shouldn't that be enough? And if it's not enough, you know, why? My viewpoint is if they're following it, maybe sometime in the future a war will come up that we need them, and isn't it better to be able to use them and not go back on our word than signing this treaty? Do you know what I mean?
I do. Thank you for calling in, by the way. We're all thrilled that the U.S. is following the treaty, even if it hasn't signed it, of course. But we believe that if the U.S. signed it, some of the other holdout countries would too. The U.S. will never again need anti-personnel landmines. Let's be realistic. How is it fighting war? It's fighting it with drones, increasingly with autonomous weapons, which, in fact, I find terrifying. And we just launched a new campaign to stop killer robots, which are not drones, but even worse. We aren't even, you know, thinking about landmines anymore. We'd have no problem signing it and obeying it.
So you think this idea that we may need to use them at some time in the future is just not realistic, and in fact, you think landmines should never be used?
Correct. Conventional weapons like guns go home with the soldier, in theory. Landmines never leave. You plant them in the ground, throw them in the river where women do their washing of clothes or gather water for dinner. You put them in the woods where they go to gather firewood. They stay there for decades and decades and decades, literally. They will continue to kill and maim grandmothers, children, women going down to wash the clothes or get water for dinner. It's insane. The limited plus for soldiers is by far outweighed by 100 years of terror with those landmines in the ground. Yes, the military has a right to protect itself, but not at the cost of generations of mayhem for civil society. It's nuts.
Let's go to Frank calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hi there. My question was where you're covering or if your treaties do anything with the awareness of cluster bombs, also in Cambodia and in Laos. And I'll just give you a little bit of my personal experience. I was in Laos, and what I did is I donated money directly to victims of injuries from cluster bombs back, and I called your office, but of course you were somewhere out doing the fabulous work that you're doing.
Which she often is. Frank, let's give Jody a chance to respond. Go ahead, Jody Williams.
You probably will be happy to hear that after the mine ban treaty success, there is a coalition to ban cluster munitions, and it too was successful, and there is a new treaty from 2008 banning cluster munitions. So we're very aware of that. The U.S. actually is a donor to the bombies, the cluster bombs in Laos that you talk about. So we're covering that as well. And now we're going after killer robots.
Jody, can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. You know, a drone is a plane that can fly essentially on its own, but there is a team thousands of miles away sometimes, like Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and they're watching a monitor, right? And they're watching the target. And when they deem the target to be a terrorist that they need to blow up, they, you know, fire the missiles that kill that person or persons. They are now planning weapons that will have no person doing the killing. They are actually believing that it is okay to create weapons that in the air, on the land, and in the sea that on their own, once programmed and released, will have decision-making power over life and death for human beings. Can you imagine that? A machine can come and decide to kill you on its own. So we decided that that was beyond the pale. It was morally and ethically bankrupt. Made us question, where is this country going? And we decided to create a campaign to preemptively ban them. And I'm very excited by it.
So is this your life, activism? I mean, will this be something that you're doing forever?
You can't give back the Nobel Peace Prize. They want living suckers who have to go out there and keep being a role model. You can't give it back.
Let's see if we can get one quick call in here.
Sure.
Estella's on the line from Montreal. Estelle, can you make it very quick here? We have just a couple of seconds with Jody Williams.
Okay, well, my question is about the Congo, which is the conflict that has incurred the most amount of deaths since World War II, and it's so very often just ignored, and I would like to know what she's doing about it, if anything.
Sure. About a year ago, the Nobel Women's Initiative spearheaded another campaign, and it's the International Campaign to Stop Rape and Gender Violence in Conflict. And we have relationships with many women's organizations in the DRC dealing with that issue, rape and gender violence in conflict. And again, we want to change the world by bringing NGOs together from around the world, pushing governments on this issue. But it's also a way to get people to look at the war itself. So we're trying to do that and ban killer robots and all sorts of other things to try to make the world a better place for everybody.
Well, and if you want to know a lot more about Jody Williams, about her activism, and about the path that led her here, specifically her childhood in Vermont, in Putney and Brattleboro, and what influence that had in her family, what influence that had on her activism, it's all in her new memoir. It's called My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. Jody, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Jane. It was really fun.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This is the 50th anniversary of Bread and Puppet Theater, an arts institution in Vermont. The group's name stems from its belief that baking bread for its audience helps create community and that art is as basic to life as bread. John Kalish prepared this report on the roots of the puppet theater that still thrives in the Northeast Kingdom.
Hay Barn Theater at Goddard College in Plainfield is packed in early June as Bread and Puppet performs a revival of an old show, The Birdcatcher in Hell. A giant face depicting the King of Hell is on stage. 10-foot-tall demon puppets pound on drums. Much of the music and speech is grating. Everyone but the birdcatcher is wearing shades of red. This play was a response to the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. This revival has drones and depicts the war on terror. Bread and Puppet is the creation of Peter Schumann. Schumann looms large as the dominating personality, an arbiter of aesthetics for the puppet theater he founded 5 decades ago. His puppetry career began with much tamer fare in 1962. At the Putney School, he ran an extracurricular puppetry workshop. After Putney, Schumann moved to New York City, where he founded Bread and Puppet in 1963. From the very beginning, the group embraced low-tech homemade puppets as a means to offer provocative comment on contemporary events.
It's the freedom, the elbow freedom that you get when you can do things because of America's garbage, and the freedom of doing gigantic things for almost nothing with just collaboration, with just people power.
In New York, the theater was part of the creative ferment of the 1960s and the political ferment as well, participating in the growing anti-war movement. But Bread and Puppet also worked with inner-city kids. Here's Schumann rehearsing a play about Chicken Little in Harlem in 1966.
Okay, just walk in place. He walks just on the spot.
Okay,
let's try that out.
But Schumann began to sour on life in New York City, and after his wife Elka was robbed at gunpoint, he accepted an invitation from Goddard College in Plainfield to become its theater-in-residence in the early 1970s. Jules Rabin taught anthropology at Goddard at the time. He remembers it being a highly politicized campus.
There was a Black Studies department that had started just that semester when we were discussing inviting Bread and Puppet, and there was a very militant guy, he had a lot of presence, a Black guy, who said, our college would better do a Black theater kind of invitation than Bread and Puppet invitation. This is more whitey stuff dominating the scene. And he didn't prevail.
I joined Bread and Puppet, and pretty much that's what I did for my college education, was in a puppet theater company touring all over the place.
That's Paul Zaloom, who was part of Bread and Puppet at Goddard and went on to star in the children's TV show Beekman's World. Zaloom joined the theater in 1971 and lived with the troupe at Kate Farm, which was part of the Goddard campus.
I would say it was about 12 of us living on the farm, and then Peter and Elka and their five kids. You know, the farm had a number of different buildings that we would live in, so we weren't really packed in there like sardines. It was pretty great. It was a beautiful location, had these giant hay fields and big old barn, and it was a really wonderful place to work and to live.
But in the fall of 1974, Bread and Puppet moved on again, leaving Goddard for a farm in the Northeast Kingdom. The farm was purchased by Elka Schumann's father, who was the son of the famous homesteaders Helen and Scott Nearing. The 160-acre farm in Glover has been Bread and Puppet's home ever since. A spring breeze cools the barn where puppeteers are rehearsing.
Bird and Chainsaw in concert.
The barn is also the Bread and Puppet Museum, filled with massive papier-mâché puppets from the theater's past. Elka Schumann stops in front of a dragon that's more than 40 years old.
This puppet was made in these children's workshops uptown in South Bronx and Harlem. Kids made it, then they used it. It had a big, long green body, and you could get 100 kids under this green cloth with rattles and whistles and tambourines and things and snake down the street. It was a really neat street puppet.
A huge gravel pit sits on the Bread and Puppet farm in Glover. The stone was used for the construction of Interstate 91. That gravel pit became a natural outdoor amphitheater, and for more than 20 years it served as the site of Bread and Puppet's domestic resurrection circus. The theater has long drawn on its natural surroundings for both performance space and to make the puppets. Materials like maple saplings growing in the sugar bush and clay from the banks of the Sheffield River. The bread of Bread and Puppet comes in the form of Schumann's coarse sourdough rye bread, which he bakes in huge quantities in a few outdoor clay ovens. But it took a while for people to accept the idea of him giving away bread.
I had a sign out and I said, free bread, nobody ever came. Then inflation struck and I changed the sign. I said, due to inflation, twice as free bread. Nobody came.
But people did come to the summer circuses and to the parades where Bread and Puppet performed in towns like Barton, Marshfield, and Cabot with colorful puppets and a raucous brass band. The puppeteers' political messages didn't always sit well with Vermonters. Again, puppeteer Paul Zaloom.
Just after the theater had moved up there, there was a 4th of July parade, and I believe the Bread and Puppet section of the parade was a group of Vietnamese women puppets being dragged through the streets by the Uncle Fatso, a kind of Uncle Sam figure. And that didn't go over too great with the local residents of Plainfield. So Bread and Puppet was sort of banned from the 4th of July parade for a number of years. And then when we were invited back, I remember a guy in town who said to me, he says, now we don't want anything political in the parade, right? Nothing political.
Peter Schumann's uncompromising political statements have ruffled feathers outside of Vermont as well. In 2001, just weeks after the September 11th terrorist attacks, Bread and Puppet bowed out of the Greenwich Village Halloween parade in New York over a theater scene about civilian casualties in the new war in Afghanistan. In 2007, an art exhibit in Boston drew complaints when Schumann compared the Israeli government to Nazis. Despite its left-leaning politics, Bread and Puppet seems to be at peace with its neighbors after close to 40 years in the Northeast Kingdom.
Anyone who can last a while around here, people figure you have to put up with them whether you like them or not.
Joseph Gresser is a writer with the Barton Chronicle. He remembers the 23 years of Bread and Puppet's summer circuses as a hell of a lot of fun, but says crowds as large as 30,000 became an incredible inconvenience for nearby towns.
What would happen is that there would be parallel events, so a lot of people would show up a week early, go to one of these campgrounds, and there would be raves, or I remember seeing a truck with tanks of nitrous oxide pulling in. And, you know, there were ODs. The emergency responders were really run ragged. That was very hard on them. It had a bit of the feel of riding the back of a tiger.
After a fight at one of the campgrounds resulted in a man's death in 1998, Schumann concluded that the event had spiraled out of control and stopped putting on the free circuses. With rare exceptions, Bread and Puppet has been able to survive without government grants or business underwriting. When the barn housing the Bread and Puppet Museum needed major structural repairs, an appeal letter brought in $90,000. Claire Dolan is a member of the theater's board of directors.
It's kind of strange and unbelievable how the theater functions economically. We don't have outreach and development person. We don't have a business planner. We just have a few people who are doing a lot of stuff all at once and sort of getting by the seat of their pants. But, you know, it's 50 years. It's been going on 50 years. That's kind of amazing.
Peter Schumann is at peace with the troupe's precarious finances.
We have constantly gone under and come up again, and we are constantly collapsing continuously, and then sort of struggle back again. It's all the time on the margin anyway, you know, which I don't mind that it is that way. I wouldn't see any advantage if it would be more successful, so to speak.
Peter Schumann just turned 79 and is in remarkably good shape. He has stopped walking on 10-foot stilts at the request of his family, but other than that, the man shows no signs of slowing down. For this summer's parades, Schumann is focused on the F-35 fighter jet that the Air Force might base in Burlington.
We created a very powerful Daffodil attack force with the Daffodil Navy and Daffodil Knights with Daffodil weaponry, and that's going to fight the F-35 very effectively.
Longtime friend Helen Rabin broached the subject of what will become of Bread and Puppet when Peter Schumann is no longer around.
Other people worry about that, but not Peter Schumann. He doesn't want to think about that. He's more concerned with what comes next.
What comes next is July 4th parades in Barton and Cabot and summer performances at the farm in Glover on Friday evenings and Sunday afternoons. Bread and Puppet's 50th anniversary season culminates with a tour of France and Italy this fall. For VPR News, I'm John Kalish.
And we want to hear your memories of Bread and Puppet and what influence you think the organization has had on the arts and politics in our region. Post a note on our Facebook page or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Now it's time for another of our summer school classes. If you're ready to graduate from rolling putts through a clown's mouth or past a rotating windmill and want to hit one across a well-manicured green, you've come to the right place. Today we learn how to avoid ever three-putting again. Roger King is the head golf pro at the Country Club of Barry and considered by some, especially himself, the best putter in the state.
The biggest thing that people tend to do is they put a little too much thought into it. You can do everything right and just miss the putt. It can lip out. You can hit it where you want. It doesn't go in. And conversely, sometimes you hit what you think is a bad putt and they go in. The biggest thing for putting with me, regardless of the physical act of actually hitting the ball, is being mentally prepared to hit the putt and to deal with the consequences thereof. The putter grip has a flat front. So all I'm doing is putting my left hand on the higher end of the grip, the top end, and my thumb goes straight down the flat side, and then I'm going to take my right hand and do the exact same thing. And what I try to do is you try to take your left thumb and have it fit under the chubby part of your thumb, so that what that does, that meshes your hands together so that they're going to work as a team. As far as pressure goes, the cliche has always been to almost feel like you're holding a tube of toothpaste that's open upside down. You're holding it, but you're not squeezing it out. And what that does, that just loosens up your muscles, loosens up your hands so that you can let the putter do what it's supposed to do. Secondly, stance-wise, the bottom line, what we're looking for is for you to be stable and not wavering. So, I mean, you can have your feet closer together, further apart, as long as you're stable. Usually what we'll do is we'll put the ball just across from our left instep. And then when you line your putter up, all you try to do is you try to get the grip and the putter head and have them move back in the same direction and through in the same direction. What that's going to do is that's going to keep the face of the putter straighter longer. These greens are nice and smooth for a reason. We want that ball to be rolling end over end as soon as possible. And you do that simply by getting almost like a grandfather clock. You know, the piece of the clock that sort of swings back and forth, it just moves together nice and smooth and even. So that's what we're looking to do. Game's easy.
That's Roger King, head professional at the Country Club of Barrie. Next week, we'll play Rumpelstiltskin and learn how to spin wool into gold. No, sorry, just yarn. But we will show you how to go from sheep to sweater. First, though, tomorrow, Oskar Schindler is well known for saving 1,200 Jews during the Holocaust. Lesser known, though, is Irena Sendler, a Polish Catholic who helped 2,500 Jewish children escape the Warsaw Ghetto. We'll learn about the Kansas high school students who brought her story to life and the Vermont doctor who's written about it. That's tomorrow at noon on Vermont Edition, so stay tuned. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.